Okay, folks, a very big hello again and welcome to the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest block-busting revelations from Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, a rock chick writer extraordinaire, Leslie-Ann Jones. Leslie-Ann, how are you this fine morning, I was going to say, fine this morning. How are you this fine morning?
Hola, Miguel. How's it hanging?
Yeah, pretty good, thanks. You know, the... I hope we're over the worst of the heat wave. I do not appreciate having to go out in temperatures of 36 degrees. Although I do find, and obviously we're under all sorts of restrictions at the moment, but when everybody goes out into the garden at the few pubs that are open and working normally, I have the inside, the cool inside to myself. So I'm quite pleased about that. Just before we get on to a series of juicy subjects, Leslie-Ann, the debate at the moment is whether or not we should close pubs in order to reopen schools. And I'm very, very much against that. What do you think?
Well, that's because you don't have kids. You know,
you don't go to school anymore.
What? Sorry?
You don't have kids at school anymore.
No, but I brought three children through the school system, and yep. I'm surrounded by friends with school-aged children who are all tearing their hair out, not just because they're homeschooling, but because their kids have lost the best part of an academic year.
Yeah.
And so we're going to end up with this lost generation, undereducated, yep. missing their exams, all of this. I think we have to put schools first, because the reason they want to close the pubs to keep the schools open yeah. is that all the children are going to be mixing, teachers, everything else. They'll all take infections home. People will then take them down the pub yeah. and thus the infection spreads around the community all over again.
Yeah.
So I think we've got to be sensible about this. Schools are more important than pubs.
Well, I'm not sure I agree, because I think that the revival of the economy, the mental health of people who can't get out to pubs and you know, socialise and all that is still very important. And if what you say is the reason behind it, and I have no reason to doubt you, although I think the two can be separated, then why can't the pubs remain open for people like me? I haven't got children, but I still want to go to the pub. So I'm not taking any diseases into pubs brought home from school by my children. No child has yet died, fortunately and thankfully, anywhere in the world of COVID-19. So it's a ridiculous overreaction again. And I wish the Prime Minister of this country would stop, you know, putting his foot on the brake and then the accelerator, then the brake, then the accelerator. It's driving people mad.
Well, that's true. But the bit that confuses me about Boris Johnson is yeah. what's all this over 50s number about? He's 56. Yeah. So is he going to be quarantining himself and not running the country anymore because he's over 50?
I totally agree with you. We're getting very mixed messages at the moment. I wish, I sometimes wonder whether, you see, he's the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister's job is to pull together all the pluses and minuses and try and come up with a sensible way forward. It just seems to me the last person who was in Boris's office and offered him a solution is the way we go next. And that changes every 10 minutes. However, we didn't ask people to join us on this podcast today to give them a lecture in politics. We invited them in today to talk about very, very much more colourful subjects, like, for instance, Jimi Hendrix. Your old friend Philip Norman is bringing a new book out about Jimi Hendrix, and we've both read some pretty, I would say, pretty juicy revelations, although not really, but you can tell me more, Leslie-Ann. Do we know anything more about the specific death of Jimi Hendrix than we knew beforehand?
Well, I'm not sure we do, having read that piece. I had lunch with Phil just before the lockdown.
Yeah.
And he was brimming with excitement about yes. Having had access to these new papers and all of these records that have belonged to someone who worked on a documentary that never actually aired. I think I've known for a long time that there were conspiracy theories
yes.
about Jimi Hendrix. And he's kind of rock's Loch Ness monster, isn't he?
Yes,
in terms of we don't actually know. Mm. We think he may have accidentally taken an overdose, because he was with a German former ice skater called Monika Dannemann
yeah.
the night he died.
Yeah.
And she had some sleeping tablets called Vesperax. Mm. And he couldn't understand the instructions on the side of the packet. Mm. And he somehow managed to take double the normal dose. So he took 9 tablets, which was 18 times the normal dose required.
He was in the habit of
taking things, let's say.
Yeah.
It's since emerged that maybe the CIA wanted rid of him because he was on some sort of list of undesirables. Maybe the mafia were involved, but why? Apparently, he took out a new life insurance policy just before he died, which was for about $2 million. And his manager is said to have commented, a guy called Mike Jeffrey, that Jimmy was worth more dead than alive.
Yes.
I mean, none of these things are provable, are they?
Well, also, that manager allegedly was in hock to the mafia, wasn't he? Borrowed some money off them, $30,000 to finance a property purchase or something, and they wanted $45,000 back. So the mad, crazy theory there is that it would be worth bumping off Jimi Hendrix. Also, I think what is intriguing, which I didn't know about until I read what we both read recently, is the role of Eric Burdon. Now, Eric Burdon, to me, was always just the sort of very badly behaved lead singer of the Animals. You know, there is a house in New Orleans, they call the rising sun, and many a young boy, and all that kind of stuff. But Eric Burdon was either a very good friend of Jimi Hendrix or the lady you've just spoken about. And there's a big dispute as to, A, when Eric Burdon got the call to say Jimmy's not well, B, how long it took him to get round there, and C, how long afterwards an ambulance was called.
Well, I think the issue there was the fact that they had a lot of drug paraphernalia around the place they were staying in, which was the Samark Land Hotel in Notting Hill.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, they were reluctant to call the police, the ambulances, because, you know, then they would have all got arrested. Yeah. Sorry?
It was the right doss hole, that place.
I think so, yeah. I think it's not there anymore. But I think the point really here is that next month, September, is the 50th anniversary of his death.
Yeah.
He died on my birthday, actually. So Jimi Hendrix has always been a sort of very big figure in my consciousness.
And you were only a toddler, of course, when he died.
Yeah, I don't even remember it, of course. No. A little school child, but there's quite some sort of mystery about that. You know, he died on your birthday. The greatest guitarist in the history of rock dies on your birthday. When you're a young teenager, you sort of come to start thinking that these things have meaning. You know, it's a sign of some sort. Of course it wasn't. The other thing, of course, is the connection to the 27 Club.
Yes.
Which, you know, quite a lot of really big name rock stars like Brian Jones of the Stones, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, much later on Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse, all died at the age of 27, and so did Jimmy.
Yeah.
So there is that sort of theory that there's something mysterious about this. I actually don't believe there is. I think he probably just overdosed.
Yeah, I think you're right. But to take 9 tablets when you were only supposed to take half a tablet, and also in the bit we read, it said that there was hardly any alcohol in his blood, although he'd been out all night, don't know what he'd been doing there. And the theory was that he'd come home and taken some wine or something with the tablets, and he drowned in his own wine. It floods your lungs and you can't breathe. It's like being waterboarded.
Well, he drowned in his own vomit, I think, because he vomited everywhere, didn't he?
Oh, dear, that doesn't sound very pleasant.
It's a very sort of sad and quite sleazy ending to what was really such a short career. But he left his mark, because every rock guitarist you can think of reveres Jimi Hendrix. Freddie Mercury was devoted to Jimi Hendrix, and he did his college thesis on him and drew pictures of him all over the walls.
Wow, that's amazing. And you're absolutely right, because there's a picture of Eric Clapton staring, you know, Google-eyed at Jimi Hendrix. I think it does go without question. It does say without question, he is accepted as the greatest ever lead guitarist in the history of rock and roll, isn't he?
Definitely. And not only that, you know, he's credited with having broken the barrier between black soul music and white rock.
Absolutely.
And that was immense, and that wasn't really recognised at the time.
No, it was quite amazing. Now, you mentioned your old pal, deceased, sadly, Freddie Mercury, and that brings me to another subject I want to talk to you about. Why are they releasing one of the worst films I think I've ever seen, Flash Gordon?
Wasn't my cup of tea, was it?
No. I mean, yeah. And it had, is that the one with Brian Blessed in it? You know, Gordon still alive.
Yeah, it is. A very sort of camp film in the old style of the 1960s television Batman, if you remember. Yeah, this sort of comic strip thing. But it had this fantastic soundtrack by Queen.
Yeah.
With actually also a little known fact, the orchestral section was by Howard Blake, who went on to become hugely famous with The Snowman.
Oh, really? Oh, was that?
Oh, really? Yes.
Yeah. We're flying through the
air. I think walking through the air may be what he did. We're
walking through the air. Yeah, okay.
Oh. But it's had a cult following, this film, for a long, long time, since the 80s. Mm. And I think, everything is reworked. Everything is re-released.
Yes.
I won't be going to see it, but I quite like the soundtrack.
Yeah, well, I just don't understand why they're re-releasing it. Although some films are more memorable for the soundtrack than they are for the actual film itself. I mean, I was asked in a show I did last week, you know, what's your favourite film of the 80s? And I said Top Gun. And it was Top Gun for two reasons. First, I thought it was a great plot. I loved it, you know, fighter jets and all that. But the sheer soundtrack, Berlin, and You Take My Breath Away and all that, that to me makes it. For instance, old, is it Jennifer Beals? You know, What a Feeling. What was that called? Flashdance, right?
Flashdance.
Yeah. Now, I thought, I don't know if you've ever seen it, I thought the film was pathetic. You know, the basic plot line was a beautiful-looking girl who had ambitions to be a top dancer but took a job as a welder so that she was dressed up all day in a horribly male suit, welding kit and all that, and to earn the money to be able to practice her dance. And then, you know, she turns out to be a genius and all that. It was a shockingly useless film, but just the soundtrack itself for me can make or break a film. I mean, what about Saturday Night Fever?
The Bee Gees cleaned up there, didn't they, really? But it's rather lovely to think that a film, a whole motion picture, can be carried by its soundtrack, which says a lot for people like Hans Zimmer, another great friend of mine, who's, what hasn't he written, really? But
I don't know. Tell me something he has written. I'm sorry. Pardon my ignorance.
Yeah, it's gone completely out of my head. But, everybody knows Hans Zimmer's work.
Right.
Look him up.
Now, that name is very similar to the one I like. Is it Van der Valk? Was Van der Valk the Dutch thing? And the guy who wrote the theme music to that was, his name was like Hans Zimmer, but it's not Hans Zimmer, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. It was a strange kind of track, wasn't it? That was quite big on television when we were kids, I think.
That's right, it definitely was. Now, listen, talking about rock stars and what they all do, what do you know about old Suggs? You know, Suggs, the lead singer of Madness, is that right?
Yeah, I have a very, very soft spot for Suggs. Okay. I think he's wonderful.
Yeah.
He's just a delightful bloke. He used to come into Chrysalis quite a lot when I worked there back in the 80s.
Yeah.
He's having a bit of a moan, isn't he, at the moment?
Mm. Well, I saw this in a paper I read recently, and, you know, he was talking about his lifestyle and all that. Now, he made the point that the problem with being in a band with Seven is that even when you get royalty checks now, they have to split between seven people plus, you know, the taxman and the accountant and your agent and all that kind of stuff. Whereas, of course, if you're a solo singer, you get it all to yourself. But surely he knew that. I always wondered how Jeff Lynne made any money with the Electric Light Orchestra, because there's about 20 of them, wasn't there?
Yeah. Well, it's the old story with bands, isn't it? Do you remember Spandau Ballet suing each other? Well, I think actually all the other members of Spandau Ballet, except Martin Kemp, who's the brother of Gary Kemp, who wrote all the songs, decided to sue Gary Kemp for a share of the royalties, and they actually lost.
Yeah.
Because it generally rests with the person who wrote the songs getting the royalties. That used to be standard. And I remember Queen, there was a big sort of turning point in their history when they agreed at a certain point to split everything four ways. But it's, it's not usual.
Very generous, isn't it? If Freddie Mercury and Brian May had written the songs.
Well, no, they all wrote number one records. Oh. All four of that band wrote, I mean, Freddie probably wrote the most, I should say, yeah. but they all wrote number ones, interestingly, which is quite rare in a band.
Did the drummer write Radio Gaga?
Yes, he did, Roger Taylor, yeah.
Because it was his birthday recently, wasn't it? I think he was 71. But no, the reason I remember that is because, of course, working in radio, I always had an affinity for that record. You know, I heard it on my radio.
Oh, God, here he goes again. It's such a great song. It's got a language of its own. You know, I remember when they performed it at Live Aid.
Yeah.
And just looking out at that vast sea of people
yeah.
and all the hands sort of going in unison and
yeah.
so on.
Yeah.
It was just so moving.
And also the graphic that went with it in the days when videos were huge was a bit sort of Dan Dare-ish, wasn't it? You know what I mean? Floating around in a spaceship. Do you remember it?
Yeah. Well, they didn't have the CGI technology that we have today.
No.
So everything was done for real back then.
Yeah, no, yeah.
So, you know, they'd get sort of thousands of extras, fans turning up to film sequences and so on,
no,
which
you're absolutely
is
right.
a thing of the past, yeah.
Absolutely right.
But going back to Suggs, I mean, I yeah. kind of hear his pain, really, because, sharing the royalties with Seven in the band, you're not going to end up with very much.
No.
And bands that could seem to have had such a glittering, huge career are now a little bit on their uppers because
yeah.
the royalties dwindle. We don't hear Madness played very much on the radio these days.
No, we don't. Why is that, do you think?
Don't know. No. I mean, some great hits there, weren't there? Did you ever go and see the musical that they had?
No.
On stage at one point, about yeah. probably, I'm guessing about 15 years ago.
Yeah, no.
It was called Our House.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. After that hit that they had, yeah, it was really good. It was produced by a friend of mine, actually, Annabelle. But I don't know. Why don't we hear Madness, DJs? We need more Madness on the radio.
Well, maybe. And also, I don't know the name of any other member of Madness apart from Suggs, and I don't even know his real name. So, you know, it's kind of one-man band in my view. Now, let me ask you something, Leslie-Ann. Have you ever bought from the Argus catalogue?
No, never have. I'm not going to miss it because I never have gone to Argus.
They're phasing it out. Some guy that I came across yesterday has had he's got every copy of the Argus catalogue going back about 40 years.
What, like football programmes or something?
Right. Yeah, he collects them and he stores them on his wall like, you know, like books. Which you'll be very familiar with, actually. You'll be very familiar with the Rothmans Footballer of the Year book. I bet your dad had shelves and shelves of them, you know, as one of Britain's leading football writers. But I've got them going back about 40 years, right? And I don't buy them anymore because the more information now on the internet, you know what I mean, than there is in the Rothmans Footballer of the Year book. But, you know, it was a badge of honour. If you were anything to do with sport, you had, you know, the last 30 years Rothmans. This guy's got all the Argos catalogues, not because he ever bought anything from there, but he said it was a great social and economic record of his life because of the way that the items inside the Argos catalogue changed from year to year and indicated what was in vogue and what wasn't. I've never bought from a catalogue like that. Didn't young girls, when you were, you know, in your early 20s, buy everything out of catalogues?
No, we went to Topshop on Oxford Circus
and
we tried things on and we strutted about. I can't really see the point of buying something from a catalogue.
No, neither can I, to be honest. And even what I disliked about Argus was it was like a false shop. You went into the shop, they gave you a catalogue, you told them what you wanted, then you went round the back and picked it up at the warehouse. And like you, you're absolutely right. If you're buying from a catalogue at home, I can understand a little bit of what you're doing. But to go into a shop called Argos and not even be able to look at anything. Anyway, look, it's for another time. Why is John Cleese moaning again, eh? He's always
God, why doesn't he shut up?
Yeah.
He's having a go because the BBC have not repeated the Monty Pythons. What I think is that the Pythons had their day. It's only funny to those of us who grew up on it.
Yeah, I agree.
But most of their material is politically incorrect and it wouldn't sit in the modern world.
Yeah.
Kids wouldn't like it. That's why they don't repeat it.
I totally agree. I remember one sketch, and it was called literally Twit of the Year. And this was about people who were clearly unstable or mentally challenged or something like that, being asked to do the simplest of tasks, like jumping over a row of boxes of matches and knocking them down and all this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? It would be utterly, highly offensive these days.
I think the parrot sketch was, you know, it's quite iconic, isn't it? It's quite sweet. But if you watch that back, it's quite silly, I think. I showed it to my kids once because they wanted to know what Python was all about. And they just kind of looked at me a bit gormlessly as if to say, you think that's funny?
Yeah.
The one I used to like was the four old gits drinking Chateau de Châtelet and reminiscing about what a terrible childhood they had. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
We always used to repeat lines from that and fall about laughing as if we were hysterical.
Sure.
And now I think even that is a bit tired.
No, I totally agree. When we were at school, if you didn't sort of come to school every Monday morning after a weekend programme, Monty Python on a Sunday night, and start, as you quite rightly say, rolling around laughing, then you weren't on the in crowd. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I never found any of it funny. Even when they were walking around just chanting spam, 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 spam. And people would start, you know, chanting that during the middle of the geography class or something like that, you know, and I'd join in because I wanted to make sure that everybody knew I was up with it, you know what I mean? But I never found it funny, and I've never found John Cleese funny. The only thing I ever found John Cleese funny in was Fawlty Towers, and they're running those again at the moment. They've been running them forever. And I thought he played the part of, you know, Basil, the bumptious, arrogant, incompetent hotel owner, brilliantly. But I've never seen him do anything else that's funny, not on a live stage show, not Monty Python's, and certainly not in the AA adverts, which he had to start doing to pay off his divorce.
No, it's true. Although I loved the sequence where he was thrashing the car with a branch because it wouldn't start. But I think with Fawlty Towers, they've got some cultural appropriation issues there because of Manuel and, you know, making fun of this kind of hapless, gormless Spaniard and so on. They're treading on thin ice there, I think.
Well, yeah, but it's still very funny. And also, my view is that if the actor who's playing Manuel, you know, is in with it as well, nobody's been made a fool of, and it's all drama. And
well, he's dead. And there was that whole thing with his granddaughter, wasn't there? And Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand making fun of her on air and got suspended and all of that. I think, what did you think of Life of Brian, by the way, the film?
I thought that was very good. That's another thing I thought was very funny, Life of Brian. You know, the Judea Liberation Front and all that.
I remember going to see that in the cinema and literally collapsing in the aisle, screaming with laughter. I think I might wince at it a bit now.
You might and all that, but no, I agree with that. Listen, I've read something very, very tragic this morning, and you may know these people because you know everybody else in showbiz, but two of the Nolan sisters are fighting cancer together. It's been revealed this morning. And of course, one of their sisters died, I think it was about 10 years ago, from cancer. It's a pretty tragic legacy for a group of sisters, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And there was this heartbreaking picture of the two of them completely bald, you know, all dressed up and made up, but with their sort of shining bald heads. And I just thought, how sad is that? Yeah. What a terrible thing, agony for this family to go through.
Absolutely terrible. And do you know what? I'm not sure whether, you know, they so brave of them to come out and their shaved heads and all that. But I think the shaved head thing looked horrible. I would always, if it was me in that position or if I was, you know, associated with a woman who was tragically fighting that, I'd say, please wear a wig. It's better, you know. It's almost like you're a professional victim, if you see what I mean, if you go around the bald heads. And I'm not criticising these two ladies. My God, you know, what they've got to put up with to support each other is enormous. But I'm not. There was a famous model, wasn't there, who had the same sort of problem for
Gail Porter, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. And I always felt it would have been better to have worn a wig. But perhaps that's been a bit unkind, yeah?
Maybe. You could say that's a sexist approach because the man wouldn't feel obliged to wear a wig, so why should the woman, really? Yeah. And they're showing solidarity with fellow cancer sufferers.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to be said for that.
Yes, no, I agree with that. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porku with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, Leslie Ann Jones, who's with me. We've been taking through a range of subjects. How well do you know Sam Mendes, Leslie Ann?
I met him once.
Yeah.
I thought it was a rather amiable guy, actually. He's incredibly gifted and skilled director.
Yeah.
And he's worked on some immense films. I mean, I know you love the Bonds.
Yeah.
So he did what, Spectre and Skyfall, yeah, didn't he?
I did those two, and he did 1917 more recently, which mm-hmm. people said was a, you know, a groundbreaking, because apparently it was all filmed on one camera over the space of about 6 weeks. You know what I mean?
Yeah, his one shot work is his speciality, isn't
yeah,
it?
That's but, right, yeah, that's right.
He was really kind of revered for American Beauty, but I think that's a bit tainted now because of the whole Kevin Spacey number that's been going on.
Yeah, no, yes, I accept that, and that's something you've got to sort of brush under the carpet a bit, because nobody was to know at the time, were they? But I only mention it because he's 55, and I have to say, 55, he's packed an awful lot into his life already, hasn't he?
He has, but are you a little bit obsessed with age, Mike?
Well, I'm not obsessed with age. I'm obsessed with what people have done at their age. And talking about that, by the way, have you seen the latest pictures of Adele? Because it's absolutely knocked me down with a feather type reaction, because Adele, with tumbling blonde hair, wearing a dress full of half moons, which apparently is the latest fashion amongst the superstars in this world, does not look like the Adele that I've been admiring as one of the world's great singers over the last 10 years.
Well, do you know what? I preferred her how she was before.
Well, I was about to say that, but I didn't want to sound like rude and complacent.
No, it's not rude. I thought I was looking at pictures of Robert Plant over the weekend.
That's exactly
right. She doesn't, for me, she doesn't look attractive. There's something not pretty about that face, the skinny down face, where I found her very beautiful as a larger lady.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. There's something false about that face. It's almost like she's had a face transplant, because much as I stare at the new face of the 7 stone less Adele, I cannot see the even slightest resemblance to the old 7 plus Adele, you know, standing on a stage in a black dress, singing into a single microphone, the sheer beauty of her voice emanating around the auditorium. I can't see it.
I think this is all born of desperation and terrible unhappiness, because her marriage broke down and she still obviously shares a little boy with her former husband. But I think this was a massive overreaction to that disintegration of her relationship.
Yeah.
And I feel that she hates herself to have done this to herself. She was more than happy all those years to be large.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a good thing to be large or not large, but that was her identity, and she's now given that away.
Mm. Well, yeah, I haven't quite thought of it that way, but I think you're absolutely right. If you walk down Oxford Street now and past her, you wouldn't notice her, and that's not a good thing for somebody who's established themselves as truly one of the greatest voices in the world.
But maybe, I mean, what if... We haven't heard yet, have we? But what if her voice sounds different now because she's lost so much weight? Because the larynx is a physiological part of the body.
So the lungs.
So what if she sounds different now? Yes, the lungs will be reduced because everything else is. Yeah. So maybe she's had it with recording, in which case, why is she projecting pictures of herself out there? I don't know. Yeah. She's wanting to maintain some aspect of her fame.
Yeah.
Otherwise, she wouldn't be showing us what she looks like.
Yeah. No,
But are we saying that we admire people who are skinny and that there's something wrong with people who are larger? Is that what she thinks? In which case, that's quite a damaged mind.
Yeah, I don't know what the motive for it is. I hadn't thought about it like you've thought about it and said, you know, self-hate and all that kind of stuff. I mean, if you're as perfect as she was, and when I say that, I mean in her bodily shape, but also her attitude to life, very down to earth, claims on a night off, she orders a takeaway, and then they all do the washing up together with her kid and whoever, her friends come round, all that kind of stuff. Quite very normal person. Hasn't locked herself away, you know, in a huge mansion in Cornwall or something like that. So,
well, she has in LA. That's where she lives.
Yeah, but everybody in LA does that, don't they? Including Harry and Meghan, who seem to stagger from one disastrous moment to another, now just been told they've got to pay up to £70,000 in legal charges for a case that the judges, you know, hasn't even considered yet, but struck part of it out. Anyway, that's for another day. Talking about singing, and I know this is something very close to your heart, Leslie Ann, because you are a regular worshipper at St Bride's in Fleet Street. The issue of the choir at Sheffield Cathedral has blown up again over the weekend. This is to remind our listeners, and I'm sure you're well aware of it, Sheffield Cathedral have decided to dismantle the choir they've had there for over 10 years because they want a more diverse choir to represent the community in which the choir live and sing and work. And somebody told me that this could be an utter disaster because it can take literally a decade to put a great choir together, as you will know from the choir at St. Bride's. And it seems a bit vandalistic to dismantle it for reasons which are not entirely linked to the ability of the choir to sing.
Well, of course, what's not being said is that this is primarily about economics. This is not about taking the style of a choir forward. It's about the fact that churches and cathedrals can't afford their choirs at the moment because none of them are working. So we are having services at St. Bride's at the moment. Whether they'll be shut down again, I don't know. But they are only said services. There is absolutely no music. And to maintain a professional choir costs
nobody playing the organ.
Nobody's playing the organ. No. Everything is said. All the prayers are said. Nothing is sung. No psalms, no hymns, nothing at all. So, it does cost a lot of money to maintain a choir. Yes. And most cathedrals and churches will find that they can't afford it because there's no money coming in, because there's no congregation.
Yes, well, of course. And nobody's putting any money in the collecting plate, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's that again is another tragedy of our current economic lockdown, is it not? Now then, tell me this. Have you ever had any dealings with John Landis?
No, I haven't.
I did a show last week, and I think I mentioned in this podcast already that I opted for Tom Cruise and Top Gun, but somebody else said, no, the greatest film ever was An American Werewolf in London. And that was down to John Landis. Now, I don't know if you know American Werewolf in London, do you? You've seen it.
I've got to tell you that my biggest fear when I was a little girl was werewolves. I used to have regular nightmares about a werewolf being trapped behind the curtains in my bedroom. And I would wake up screaming the place down and all my family would come belting into my bedroom and all stand there. And I'd be going, what? Hmm. You were screaming your head off. Oh, yes, there's a werewolf behind the curtain. Yeah. So the last film I'm ever going to go and see is An American Werewolf in London.
Right, really? It's a great film, by the way. It's,
After you.
I thought it was great. I've seen it a few times. I think it's a great film because these two guys are hitchhiking through, a remote part of Yorkshire, and they're going to a pub where there's a star on the wall and all that. And the place goes deadly quiet as they walk in, and then they're told they're not welcome, and the last thing they're told as they leave the pub is stick to the paths, lads, don't leave the paths. And then you hear like a wailing noise in the background.
I'm going cold here. I have to go and lie down.
And of course they throw off the path, and what happens? But the main theme of the film is that if you get attacked by a werewolf but you're not killed, you turn into a werewolf yourself, you see. And so it went off there. But the reason I mention it is because I read a review of John Landis's work, because what he's most famous for is Michael Jackson's Thriller. Now, that must be something with which you are incredibly familiar with. Do you remember where you were the first time you saw Michael Jackson's Thriller video?
No. Maybe in a record company. I think I was working in one at the time. But it was groundbreaking, wasn't it?
Oh, it was sensational. And I couldn't understand why Michael Jackson made it in the first place, because, he had all these, right-on type views on life and, equality and all that kind of stuff. And the minute I saw it, I thought, golly, there's going to be plenty of people in the religious world protesting about this video with these zombies, all pushing their gravestones aside and coming out of the earth and all that kind of stuff. And sure enough, of course, a couple of months later, he issued an apology, didn't he?
Well, he did, but I think this is just indicative of America's obsession with Halloween. When we were kids, we had Guy Fawkes Night. We didn't have Halloween. That's an American thing. And then I think those kind of Halloween horror movies started to come out, didn't they, a few years in.
Yeah.
And suddenly Halloween was, I know what it was. It was E.T. There's the Halloween party in E.T.
Yeah.
And at that point, Halloween was imported into the UK as the big thing.
Yeah.
And I'm going, what's happened to Guy Fawkes Night?
Yes.
Which was fine for us, wasn't it?
Yes.
A bit of a penny for the guy, buy a few fireworks, have a bonfire.
Yeah.
No, suddenly you've got to go the whole hog with the undead and with zombies and with dressing up. And and it just went too far, as Americans tend to do.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, no, I totally agree. That was, by the way, Michael Jackson at his absolute zenith, wasn't it? Would you agree? that, you know, Michael Jackson's career had a, it was like a parabola. It went up and reached a huge point. He stayed there for quite a while, and then just started sliding down the other side of the parabola when all the sorts of strange stories from Neverland started sort of filtering through. But at that point on with Thriller, and at that point, Michael Jackson was not just the biggest star in the world, he was the biggest star that had ever been in the world. When I was working in America and Michael Jackson arrived in a town to do a concert or something like that, the local police chief would delegate 300 officers to meet Michael Jackson at the airport, to surround his hotel while he was there, to escort his convoy, you know, to the auditorium and escort it back. It was astonishing. He had more power than the president.
Yeah, he did. A really close friend of mine, a guy called Jonathan Morrish, was Michael Jackson's personal PR and confidant for 28 years.
Really?
And he used to let Michael babysit his children. Yeah. And he says, I spent more time with Michael than maybe anybody else.
Yeah.
I can tell you for sure that that guy is not a paedophile.
Mm. Yeah, well, everybody's got their own view on that, haven't they? And of course, that'll rumble on forever. But his sheer power, I saw him get an award once at the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I mean, it was astonishing, the entourage he brought with him, you know, 12 stretch limos. And it was just amazing. It was more than a sort of presidential cavalcade that you used to have to stop the traffic for in Washington, D.C. It was like that. They stopped the traffic in Manhattan, in New York, one of the most crowded suburban areas in the world, to allow Michael Jackson's entourage to drive through. It's quite amazing. The other guy who was connected with him, by the way, who I dealt with a few times but was always a bit wary, was it Andy J. Tabarelli? Or what, remember the guy I'm talking about?
Tabarelli was involved in the whole sex scandal thing, wasn't it?
Well, I think he was sort of Michael Jackson's unofficial spokesman for it, wasn't he? Or was he on the other side? I can't remember now.
No, Frank DeLeo was his manager.
Oh, that's right.
Frank was always around for many years. But I remember the Bad Tour. We were in Rome on the first night of the European tour in 1988.
Wow.
At the Flaminia Stadium, yes. Football stadium.
Yes.
And, you know, the press box in the old days, you know how press box worked.
Yeah, yeah.
With the banks of telephones all kind of plugged in.
Yeah.
And we were all phoning friends and family at home.
Yeah.
and holding out the receivers so that they can listen to the gig, you know, live down the telephone.
Yeah, yeah.
But you couldn't get close to him. DeLeo did all the press conferences. Mm. And we were running around Rome. I found Michael Jackson, and I've written about this quite extensively since.
Yes.
I found him in disguise, dressed up as an old tramp in an old brown raincoat and a hat and gloves and everything, down by the Trevi Fountain. And I bought him an ice cream. He had a strawberry flavoured ice cream with kind of honey sort of streaming through it.
Yeah.
And he didn't have any money because, like, the royal family never carried money, the king of pop.
Yeah.
And we sat down by the Trevi Fountain. We had an ice cream. And I said, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be at the sound check, you know. And just kind of Roger Taverner was with me at the time. He would remember this clearly.
Yeah.
And Roger took some pictures on an old Canon Sure Shot that he was carrying around with him.
Yeah.
Left the sorting camera in the cab and we never got it back. Yes,
no.
Absolutely true. We had to get Michael back to the hotel. He said he just wanted to have a day as a tourist, going around Rome, looking at the Colosseum and the fountain and the Spanish steps and all the things he'd read about. He just wanted to be incognito. But because he was Michael Jackson, he hadn't got a clue where he was. Mm. And he couldn't get himself back to the hotel.
So how did you find him in the first place?
He was just standing there.
What?
We were just having a wander around Rome on a morning off.
I can't believe it.
Happened.
And how,
Reza, it happened.
And how come, like, half of the rest of Rome hadn't recognised Michael Jackson?
Because he was in disguise. He was dressed up as an old tramp.
So how did you recognise him?
Well, because we were there, point blank range, looking at his face. It was obviously Michael Jackson.
But that must have been an astonishing moment in your life to think, hang on, is someone looking at it? It'd be like looking at Jesus in those days.
Yeah. Well, I knew his brother, Jermaine. I had a sort of friendship going with Jermaine. Yeah. And Janet, I knew. LaToya, I knew well. I sort of shared a flat with her in New York for a bit, in the Trump Tower of all places.
Right.
So I knew the family. I'd met the mother, Catherine. I'd met Joe, the father, who was a very strange guy.
Yeah.
So they weren't pop royalty to me. These were, these were, you know, my rock and roll people.
Good girl. That's an astonishing story. And you got him back to the hotel eventually, and did you get two VIP tickets for the show and all that?
We already had our passes. We were passed up to the hilt, you know, triple A's, the whole bit.
Yeah,
but there was a banquet that night in this wonderful...
Areas.
Yeah. There was a banquet that night in this fabulous castle somewhere.
Yeah.
And, of course, Michael didn't even put in an appearance.
Yeah, he didn't even put an appearance. Amazing.
No.
An amazing episode, that is. Fantastic. Talking about Mr. Taverner, by the way, and I hope he's well and thriving.
I hope he's listening. Sure. I bloody well ought to be.
I hope he's listening. That's right, yeah. You know, there was a review. I mean, I don't know why they keep doing them, but there was a review programme on Princess Diana last week. I don't know if you saw it, did you?
I seem to watch nothing but programmes about the royals at the moment.
Exactly, that's right. This Princess Anne, there was one on, that was very good.
But it was good, yeah.
This one was on Diana, and I don't know why it suddenly came up again. And, of course, they showed the famous picture of Diana in the see-through dress holding two children in her hands, and that was taken at the nursery school she worked at in London, right? Now, Mr. Taverner, when he was working for the Press Association, where he was a top reporter along with Peter Kent, he was sent to see this woman, you know, Diana Spencer, before, you know, the Diane mania had sort of swept the country. And he spoke to her, and he claims that she said the nearest thing that she'd ever said to anybody about being, you know, her intention to be betrothed to Prince Charles, okay? And so I remember Tav came back to the PA, which was then based in Fleet Street, actually on Fleet Street. And they put the story out saying that, you know, for the first time it indicated the relationship. And all the newspapers were so scared of carrying that they bylined Rog in every paper. And the first one that came out was the Evening Standard, because you could have, you know, editions up till 3 or 4 o'clock in those days, right? And I remember distinctly a picture of Diana, headline, you know, I Love Charles or something like that, you know, something akin to that. But the byline was by Roger Taverner of the Press Association. Nobody, none of the papers, would actually take it upon themselves to use any of the reporters' own names. That's how unsure they were about whether or not they could actually believe this line, which was a bit of an insult to Rog, really. But, you know, it was Fleet Street craft, wasn't it?
The thing about Roger, he was such a fine reporter and he never got it wrong. When he honed in on something, he absolutely knew that he'd nailed it. And he had such confidence in the fact that what he had was correct and true that he always sailed with it. And I think that made him a very valuable commodity on Fleet Street.
Oh, no, I think it was great. I loved working with him. I worked with him on Fleet Street when I was at the Evening Mail, Birmingham Evening Mail in London. He was at the PA, and then we actually got together again a couple of years later. It was only a couple of years later, both working on the Daily Express in Manchester. I was then moved to London with the Express, and Roger took over my house in Manchester and lived there whilst I was in the South. And then we went up again on the Express in London, I think. Yeah, I'm thinking.
He was the best of his generation. He killed the competition, didn't he?
Yeah. The other guy, Peter Kent, Pete was a right chancer, honestly, and I say that with the greatest of affection, but, you know, Peter would go off on a story and come back with the most astonishing and lurid exclusives. I'm not criticising the boy at all. He was great, but he was far more outgoing about it than the rest of us. But anyway.
I stayed in his house in Florida once.
Who's Peter's?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because he went and worked for the National Enquirer, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And I think he was a survivor of the Lockerbie disaster.
No.
I think he was due to get on that plane, wasn't he? And he didn't get on for somebody else.
Well, he might have told you that story, but I don't think that's a car. I think I don't know.
I wish that were true.
I was friends with Peter for a long time. And in fact, actually, it's quite tragic. Peter was very outgoing. He was very confident. He and Tav, by the way, lived next door to each other in identical houses in Manchester, near somewhere like Altrincham or something like that. You know what I mean? They both had white Rover cars and they both had long black leather overcoats. They were almost like the Blues Brothers. You know what I mean? who work together. But no, funnily enough, and I know Roger's done very well, and Peter had this long career in America. With he wasn't just the Inquirer. Did he work for the Star as well, or the Globe, or something? I think he worked.
Oh, I think the Boston. No, not the Boston Globe. The Globe magazine.
Yeah,
Globe
magazine. Yeah, yeah. 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 I think so. Yeah. But no, a few years ago, I got a. I was contacted by Peter Kent's brother, and I had met him once or twice when I worked in Fleet Street, and I said, "Yeah, hello." I can't even remember his name actually, and I'm not being dismissive. But he said that Peter's career had sort of petered out in America, as all careers do, you know, we get to a certain age and all that, and then you reinvent yourself and do something else. But Peter had come back to this country, didn't have any references whatsoever to, you know, impress anybody in this country. And would I give him a reference? And I said, well, what do you want to do these days? Oh, we want to get back into some form of the media, you know, and you've done radio and you've done newspapers, you work with, could you? And I declined that offer, and I don't want to sound like a wicked person, but I didn't know what he'd been up to the previous 10 years. You see what I mean? So yeah. So I had no idea about his track record of the previous 10 years. And whilst I'm not suggesting for a moment he'd done anything wrong at all, I just wasn't able to judge, you know, his work over the previous 10 years. And I think it would have been wrong of me to have given a reference in case after he went to see somebody, an employer rung me up and said, well, did you know about this? You know what I mean?
Yeah, you've got to protect. You've got to protect your own reputation. It's somebody hasn't bothered to keep in touch with you for a decade. Yeah. You know, do they really deserve your endorsement?
Well, I would have been happy had I been able to meet him and talk about it and get through it. But, you know, with Pete, it was always a bit of sort of, you know, 50 shades of grey, if you see what I mean. You know what I mean?
And why does his brother ring you up? Why can't he be the one to call you?
Well, that, again, was something that I thought about. I thought, well, actually, if this was going to work out properly, then it should have been direct. Anyway, look, I'm not knocking the lad. We all have ups and downs in life. We all have to, as I say, I've been reinventing myself for the last 20 years. And you too, Leslie-Anne, you're now a best-selling author after being a rock chick writer extraordinaire, as I keep reminding people. Anyway, Leslie-Anne, once again, we come to the end of another chapter. Delightful to talk to you again. And let's hope that everybody stays safe until we are next talking. We do wonder when we may be able to get back into a studio. But, you know, as we said at the start of this podcast, it's a bit stop-start, isn't it?
Well, it is, but we keep going, you know. The old can-do wartime spirit is alive and well.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it is. Right, Leslie-Anne, take care of yourself. Have the odd glass of sherry and a bowl of cornflakes with your favourite oat milk on them, okay?
It'll be champagne all the way for me.
Champagne all the way. Talk to you again very soon.
And take care.
And to everybody else, take care and goodbye.
But they all wrote number ones, interestingly, which is quite rare in a band.
Did the drummer write Radio Gaga?
Yes, he did, Roger Taylor, yeah.
Because it was his birthday recently, wasn't it? I think he was 71. But no, the reason I remember that is because, of course, working in radio, I always had an affinity for that record, you know. I heard it on my radio.
Oh, God, here he goes again. Yeah. We had to get Michael back to the hotel. He said he just wanted to have a day as a tourist, going around Rome, looking at the Colosseum and the fountain and the Spanish steps and all the things he'd read about. He just wanted to be incognito. But because he was Michael Jackson, he hadn't got a clue where he was. And he couldn't get himself back to the hotel.
So how did you find him in the first place?
He was just standing there. We were just having a wander around Rome on a morning off.
I can't believe it.
It happened.
And how come, like, half of the rest of Rome hadn't recognised Michael Jackson?
Because he was in disguise. He was dressed up as an old tramp.
So how did you recognise him?
Well, because we were there, point blank range, looking at his face. It was obviously Michael Jackson.
But that must have been an astonishing moment in your life to think, hang on, it'd be like looking at Jesus in those days. Is it Jennifer Beals? You know, what a feeling. What was that called? Flashdance, right?
Flashdance.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen it. I thought the film was pathetic.